On this week's Devils in the Details, United are reportedly in advanced talks for Bayern Munich's Matthijs de Ligt. How does he fit the side, and does he represent good value at some of the reported fees? Rumors also persist suggesting Manuel Ugarte of PSG could be an alternative addition to some names we spoke about last week in midfield. How does he compare to those options? Ten Hag's staff has also experienced two new incomings, with former United striker Ruud van Nistelrooy joining the club's coaching team alongside Go Ahead Eagles manager René Hake. What do we know about them, and what does this mean for the tactical outlook next season? Okay, so that's one of our longest intros of all time. Reflective of the news United have had this week, how are you? How are you feeling about the news? How are you enjoying the football going on right now?
I'm doing well, Aaron. I'm doing quite well. Yeah, the football's been good. The football's been entertaining. I love international football. There's something really special about it that cannot be quantified. Yeah, haven't been let down yet.
Yeah, it's looking pretty good for you guys, I think. And, I mean, we have a question, actually, about international football that I think we'll do later. But, yeah, it's looking pretty good for you guys. And also for Canada. So, it looks like a pretty good time to be a member of Devils in the Details. Wait until August when that completely changes.
Yeah. The tonality of this podcast will change drastically, I fear.
All right, let's get started. The biggest link, and perhaps the most likely at this point, Matthijs de Ligt of Bayern Munich, seems to be joining United. De Ligt, obviously, was captain of Ten Hag's Ajax side, the first one that made the Champions League semi-final. He has since been at Juventus and Bayern Munich, commanding fees of over 70 million, I think, when he moved to Juventus, over 60 million when he moved to Bayern Munich. Now there are rumors United could be signing him for a fee in the region of 40 to 50 million euros, or I guess 34 to roughly 42, 43 million pounds. This is based off the fact that Bayern Munich are looking to do some shakeups at the back, and Ten Hag is clearly pretty interested. United seem interested off the back of kind of reaching an impasse in negotiations over Jared Branthwaite, who we spoke about last week. Case, let's get started here. What do you think about De Ligt, as someone who has probably watched him more than the average person over the last few years?
Yeah, so I have seen quite a bit of him. I've seen him obviously play for the Dutch national team for Ajax. I saw quite a bit of him for Bayern Munich. I didn't watch him so much while he was with Juventus, but I have spoken to people who did watch him at Juventus. In general, I think at the price point, I think this is a good move. I don't think he is... I'll start with the negatives. This is not a super talented player on the ball. He's not a liability on the ball. I think he's... I've used the comparison to Rafael Varane a few times on Twitter and conversations with people about this transfer. And I think, Aaron, you were talking about this earlier today. He is better on the ball than Varane is. I would say he's much more confident as a passer. He can drive the ball to a much greater degree, especially on his right foot. Yeah, so there's that. That said, still not very progressive, not very adventurous with his passing, and also not really a player who you want isolated in space. I wouldn't say he's particularly press resistant. I wouldn't say he's a particularly good ball carrier, though he's not a horrible ball carrier, just not excellent. As for the defensive side of things, he's a really good pure defender. I don't think that's really up for debate. This is a very strong, aerially dominant, very fast center back. And I think he's generally pretty technically sound in terms of his challenges. I don't think there are a lot of things to pick at in terms of his the defensive side of his game. He's a little bit error prone, and he isn't fantastic in defending wide areas, I think. He played on the right side of a back three for the Dutch national team briefly at the 2022 World Cup and also at the 2020/2021 Euro. And he didn't cover himself in glory in those matches. But for the most part, I think that's a role thing. Playing as a wide center back, especially in the context within which he was doing so, demands two things. Basically, the first thing being you're very comfortable as a ball carrier, almost a fullback, really, in that context, because you're often isolated against the touchline. And then The other thing that you need to be able to do is to defend space, especially in isolation. And I think he's a perfectly fine isolation defender, to be honest with you. But in wide areas, he's a bit awkward. He's not a fullback. And so I think it was a miscasting of him. But in a back four, I think this is a very good right center back. And the real questions about like ceiling come from what he does in possession. What do you think, Aaron? I know you did some watching recently and you have some thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with most of what you said. Maybe I'll substantiate it a little bit more. In terms of the comparison to Varane on the ball, or in general, I think a lot of it holds weight. When you say he's better on the ball, I think I could probably elaborate upon that by saying he's more confident, and his passes, therefore, I think, have better weighting. And then also, when presented with the opportunity to play through the lines, because the weighting is better, he can play passes between the lines occasionally that midfielders can take in a stride pretty easily. So even though it's a small difference, I think it's quite material in comparison to a player like Varane, who basically was not passing the ball into midfield in his time playing for United. He would cycle the ball for the most part between, you know, his left-sided partner and then the right back, and then occasionally hit a switch to the left back, but very rarely did he see other stuff from Varane's game. I don't think that'll be the case at De Ligt. I think you'll get two or three times a game where he'll play the ball into midfield successfully. I think the passes out wide and the passes to his partner will be more confident. I think he'll lead to his presence in the side will lead to fewer ball losses than Varane. I don't think Varane lost it like directly many times for United, but I think often the lack of security with which he played the ball led to higher pressure scenarios for other defenders in the side for United. I don't think that'll be as much of a problem with De Ligt. But overall, I agree with you. Unspectacular passer. Not the worst trait when, in all likelihood, you're going to be playing next to Lisandro Martinez. But right. Yeah, not a player I would sign for his passing ability. And I would say, like, in comparison to some of the other names we've talked about, players like Todibo, definitely way better on the ball.
Yeah.
Players like Branthwaite, I think, not maybe so much better right now, but have a higher ceiling on the ball. I do think De Ligt has a better right foot than Branthwaite. Many people have been talking about Branthwaite's right foot. So
I think maybe the best way to understand the difference between him and Varane is that De Ligt has a certain level of technical, a technical baseline that allows his athleticism to play in possession to a similar extent that it plays out of possession, which wasn't true of Varane because he was sort of awkward with the ball. He lost it under his feet sometimes. That doesn't happen to De Ligt. And I also, you might actually see there's some clips that will go around, especially when he gets sold and bought, which has happened a few times in the last few years, of him at Ajax going on these sort of mazy runs with the ball. He's not a great ball carrier, but like I said, the level of technicality that he has means he can leverage his athleticism with the ball. So sometimes he's pretty hard to stop when he does get going. It's just he will rarely get going. And he's not such a good technician that he should be doing it more often than he does, which is a few times a season. So I guess that's sort of the difference. Like, you would never see Rafael Varane going on a run with the ball. And it's because he didn't have the baseline technicality to complement the athleticism that he did have. And that's not true in this instance. But anyway, go ahead. Out of possession.
Yeah, I don't think I watched quite enough to see him being exposed in wide areas during this particular watch. I've seen that in the past. And even then, I wouldn't say it's bad. I would say it's like a little bit shaky at times. And perhaps against fast dribblers sometimes, particularly ones with tricky skill sets in wide areas. The other defensive thing I saw was, I think he's a little bit more aggressive than Varane. Sometimes he steps out of his line to try and make a challenge when he sees an opportunity to win the ball. And he's fast, but I don't think he's like blisteringly quick. And so I don't think he comes out of those scenarios with as much success as someone like, this is probably an extreme example, but like Antonio Rudiger, who's a player who can just roll over people and I think almost is too aggressive, but because of how strong he is athletically, he basically never gets rolled. There are times when even like you get these scenarios where, and I think it would be harsh to compare him to Lindelof in these scenarios, but you see Lindelof do this a lot where he'll step out of the back line, follow another player out of the back line, and then get turned. And the correct thing to do in that scenario is either, of course, win the challenge or foul. And I think for the most part, De Ligt is a lot better at that than Lindelof, but not elite at that. Like I have seen him in multiple matches get beaten in those scenarios. Overall, yeah, I think this is a good defender. I guess the worry for me is that his on ball and the balance of what he provides as a defender means that in 2 to 3 years, you're going to look to replace him as a starter in this side. I think that's like the low end outcome. There are also some worries about his injuries.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable concern, the injuries. And something that I don't know that much about. Like I wouldn't feel confident commenting on whether or not that's going to be a problem going forward.
Yeah, it's a hard one when you're on the outside, but yeah, if that's a problem, that's also a big red flag of signing him, but I don't see any concern. Like this is we have a very big sample size of this player at the top level. I don't think there's a huge amount of variability in what he's going to offer. I think he's probably going to be a good squad player. I think he's possibly going to be a good starting 11 player. I don't think he's going to be one of the best defenders in the Premier League. And by that, I mean like top five. I think the balance of that, when you look at, I did a quick exercise and I don't think it's particularly meaningful, but we looked at like what other teams are spending on their second, third, fourth choice or fourth best center backs. And most of them are spending in the 30 to 40 million range. The outliers being Man City, who spent close to 50 million on John Stones when they purchased him, and Liverpool, who have barely spent anything on their current center backs except for Van Dijk and Konate. I think De Ligt for high 30s to low 40 millions kind of goes in line with that. So yeah, I think this largely makes sense. I'm not thrilled about it, but I think it's a prudent move that makes United better, deeper, and younger in this position, which should be the primary goal.
Yeah, I think I'm higher on him than you are. I don't think this is a squad player. I think this is a first 11 player, and I think it's a value-added first 11 player. Whether he's one of the best defenders in the Premier League, I don't think he winds up being one of the top five all-around center backs in the league, but I think there's a decent chance this is one of the top five pure defenders in the league. I agree about what you said about him getting rolled. I do think he follows into midfield very enthusiastically and sometimes gets beaten in those situations. I think that's the key difference between him and someone like Virgil van Dijk, who I think is much more intelligent about his decision-making in those scenarios, much more reserved about following players into midfield and wins when he does. But I think this is a really strong, pure athlete at the position. And I think that's sort of the key takeaway and why I feel pretty strongly that this is a starter.
I think right now he's definitely a starter. I guess my question is, if you find he's not particularly great on the ball, in a couple of years' time you might go, all the other teams around us have a better starter in this position, maybe we replace him. But I think if you're paying 35 to 40 million based on what we're seeing from other teams, my point was that seems pretty par for the course for a player who is kind of on the fringes of your starting 11 and is under 25.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think I would caveat it with this. I'm not sure you're going to find that many players who are as good as he is as a pure defender and significantly superior on the ball and young. Like, I think that's a pretty tough set of things to find. Like, he's an imperfect player, but also difficult to upgrade on. We have a lot of players like that, or we have in the last 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've also talked about that in the past few weeks, right? The only kind of, especially how he profiles as a partner for Lisandro Martinez, he adds the height. I like how he approaches aerials a lot, actually, from what I've seen. He's not extremely tall, but I think the approach is good and the success rate is good. He is fast enough to play in a high line. There's been a lot of conversation with Maguire about that, And ultimately, I think the conclusion is I think Maguire is fine in a high line, but not like a standout defender. Most of his standout actions come inside the box in like defensive scenarios as an out of possession player. And I mean, I think when we were profiling for a replacement for Varane, partner for Lissandro, we were looking at, you know, height, high line defending, comfort on the ball. He's pretty much got all three. I've had reservations about Branthwaite, Tadebo, as well as players like Gueye and Chalobah in this position, all different reservations. The only perfect fit, like we said last week, was Lenny Yoro. Doesn't look like United are going to get him. So, yeah, I think in terms of how he profiles, it also ends up being quite a good fit and good value for money if he can stay fit.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I think as for the aerials, I think he's a big set-piece threat is another thing. I wouldn't compare him to Maguire in general as a player. I think Maguire is a much better ball player. I think De Ligt is a lot faster and better on the turn. One thing that they do have in common is major attacking set-piece threats. And I think De Ligt may even have like the edge here in terms of his ability to technically head the ball. I think he keeps the ball down really well. He's scored a lot of key goals in his career. Yeah, but yeah, I think I agree with the ultimate conclusion, which is this is a, given what's needed, it's a pretty good fit. I also like how he partners with Lisandro Martinez. That said, I don't think you're going to next season be talking about like, who's better, him or Saliba? Like, I think like that absolute top line center back, he is not going to be because of the limitations on the ball.
Awesome. Well, a lot of what Ratcliffe has been talking about in interviews is the fact that he wants to gradually raise the floor of the squad over time. And build a team that can be competitive at this level and then go for perhaps big stars. I think we're seeing a lot of signs of that with De Ligt. And I'd argue based on what we've been talking about the last few days, there are a lot of signs of that with Manuel Ugarte. So Ugarte, 2001 born, defensive or central midfielder for PSG. But I think he made his name more so playing for Sporting, who were in the latter stages of the Europa League, knocked out Arsenal, as well as the group stages of the Champions League last season under Ruben Amorim. Ugarte has been linked to United after his move to PSG for roughly £52 million, hasn't really panned out as planned. I think last summer he was a big name as an alternative to, you know, the extremely expensive defensive midfielders who moved last summer in Declan Rice and Moises Caicedo. You and I really wanted Caicedo at the club. He ended up joining Chelsea. This seems like it's an alternative to Amadou Onana, who we've talked about before. Rumor has it that Onana is quite expensive. Case, let's talk about Ugarte a little bit. What are your thoughts on Ugarte as a player?
Oh, yeah. So, Ugarte. I think Ugarte is very much, definitely an Onana alternative in terms of his role that he would play in the side. This is a defensive midfielder. Good ball winner. I think that's really the thing that made him stand out when he was with Sporting and got him that move to PSG. I like him. I wouldn't say I love him as a player, but I think he definitely has the necessary physicals to play the position at the Premier League level, which if you guys remember last year, we were talking about Sofyan Amrabat when United made a move for him. And we said, you know, the real variable thing for him is going to be whether he's physically at the level to play the position for a side of United's caliber. I wouldn't say that's the question with Ugarte. I think it's clearly, this is a player who's above average physically for the Premier League. He's relatively quick. Like, he can move, which I think, you know, if you watched a lot of Casemiro last season, this is definitely an upgrade in the mobility department from him. He's an aggressive ball winner like Casemiro, but I would say his technical level is higher. He's more careful, comfortable receiving the ball, carrying it under pressure. he's not excellent in terms of his press resistance, but I think he's at a decent level, a usable level. And I also think his passing range is fine. I think he's consistent with the ball on the ground over short distances and medium distances. He can play a clipped ball to the wings. He can pass over longer distances. I think it's not necessarily a strength, but he's capable of it. I think my only real concern with him, and when you and I spoke about this, is he might be overly aggressive. He's definitely zealous when it comes to ball winning, and that can be useful in the counter press, but both based on the eye test and also there's some advanced metrics that show him as having had a really negative impact on PSG's defensive stability last season when he was on the pitch. I think you can see that he is perhaps rash when it comes to transition defense and jumping in versus delaying. I would say those are my general thoughts. What about you? What do you think about him?
Yeah, I think those concerns are half, you know, a big problem and then half player profile and perhaps on PSG's part, not playing him in an optimal role. Like, I don't think he should play at the base of a 4-3-3 on his own. And for Sporting, I went to watch a few Sporting matches in prep for this as well. He plays as more of a kind of double pivot where occasionally when he does break out of his position to try and win the ball, the other midfielder in the pivot, who was often Gonsalves, steps back to block him and then, cover for him. And then when he sits back, that midfielder can advance, which is actually pretty well suited to what I think he would end up doing alongside Kobbie Mainoo at United. Yeah, I think he is very aggressive and he's quite fast. Especially initial acceleration, he can break into a pretty quick sprint really quickly. I don't think his top line speed is spectacular, but that's a nice trait when you're in that position. Think of someone like, I don't know, Fred, where Fred could his body positioning and then reading into a situation where he could win the ball. And then his acceleration out of a standstill was really fast. And that gave United a lot of advantages in the press. I don't think he's quite as fast as Fred, but I think he's a much stronger tackler. And then I also think he's more disciplined than Fred in terms of sitting back a little bit more. Whereas I think Fred was like overtly an advanced ball winner.
That's interesting. I actually think he's faster than Fred. I think Fred's
interesting
greater attribute was more his acceleration and his engine than it was his straight line speed. And I think Ugarte is faster over a longer distance.
Yeah, that's actually fair. I don't know. I'm not sure if that's true, but it seems fair to me. Like
I wouldn't take a strong stance on it either way, but I see the comparison to Fred in certain aspects. I think he definitely has a similar engine. I think this is a guy who can run for 90 minutes, which is a real positive and something we talked about as being important last year, last summer in particular. And I think that's sort of one of his physical edges. That said, I will say I don't think he's particularly strong in aerial duels. I don't think he's as bad as Fred was, for example, but...
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think in the context of his aggressiveness, it's less of a problem if you're partnering him with Kobbie Mainoo, but it really does kind of lean into your reliance on Mainoo, I think. If Mainoo goes out, I don't think you really have another player in the squad, provided Casemiro leaves. And Amrabat doesn't return that can sit deep and cover for when he's a little more aggressive. Like I could see, for example, if you got, let's say, Amadou Onana and you paired him with Mount and Bruno in midfield, I think there's a chance you have problems in buildup. I don't particularly worry about that midfield from a defensive coverage standpoint. I think you have players who can carry out a variety of responsibilities. I felt the same way about Casemiro at his best. I don't feel the same way particularly about Ugarte. I think you would have to play him with Mainoo in order to get the best out of both of them. And then I think Mainoo would basically have to play every game if this is the only midfield signing you make this summer, which I don't love. In terms of on the ball, I think the main limitation for me, was actually kind of his close control in particular situations. It felt like he let the ball loose a little bit. I think when he gets going, his dribbling can be really powerful for a central midfielder. And like Kay said, he can get off a good range of passes decently accurately. He can break lines occasionally when the opportunity presents itself. Like, I don't think he is a pure ball winner by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah, I think ultimately I would say that his ceiling would be much higher if he had better close control. I think you would have a player who is more likely to run through midfield a little bit more. But overall, I think you do have an above average player both in and out of possession, if not spectacular in either. So once again, I think I'm in a position where if this is a kind of 35 to 40 million, reinforce the squad, make United better, younger, deeper, then I probably wouldn't have too many issues with it. But I will say that I have more reservations in this position when Amadou Onana seems to be available. At center back, I think you can kind of justify De Ligt more by saying this perfect player or very good player for what United need doesn't really exist in this window. Whereas in this position, I really feel like this is just not a player who excites me as much as Onana. And so unless Onana proves to be really expensive or stays at Everton, I think you're probably missing out by not going and getting the best player you can find. But that's not to say I don't like Ugarte. I think I've watched probably a dozen central midfielders at this point for United this summer, and he's probably one of the better ones among the players I've seen for what United need.
Yeah, agreed on that. I think this is a player who can start for United, and I think you can also relatively easily upgrade on him and still use him as a squad player. So it's not a bad move, I think, at the price point that's being proposed. But it also, I doubt very much that this would be transformative for the midfield in the way that I think that the midfield probably ultimately needs to be transformed over the next few years.
Yeah, I think if you're looking at the long-term future of this midfield, you have Mainoo as a starter. You possibly have Mount, but I don't think you definitely have Mount. You might decide to use Mount as a, like, positionally versatile rotation player who just comes into the side in different roles and positions. You might try to get him down to a specific position and then sign a third midfielder who fills the gaps created by those two. I think right now, though, what you kind of need, if you're sticking with Bruno, is a player who can do the defensive yards and is press resistant enough that you don't have to use Bruno in buildup. I think Ugarte does that to a reasonably good extent. I think he's good enough to play for United even beyond his perhaps lifespan in the starting 11, which he would definitely be in now. So yeah, not a bad move by any stretch. I'm just not super excited by this.
Yeah, and I think I agree with that. I think of the two moves we've discussed today, this is the lesser of the two in terms of impact.
Marginally. I think, like I said, for me, it comes down to what else United could do if they did not do these moves. With De Ligt, I still feel like you're getting a decently high outcome across the center backs that are available. Whereas with Ugarte, I do feel like I said, there are a few names who I would really like to see more than him. Overall, there's also this general sense of, like, I think you're buying players who have a pretty big sample for their age at the highest level. Players who played in the Champions League, Europa League, top leagues for big teams, who play possession-based systems. I think you might find there's more value to be found in taking a little bit more risk. But like I said, it doesn't seem like that's what the board are looking to do this summer. I think time will tell whether their attitude changes over time as perhaps they find more stability. And so for that reason, I don't think that this approach is necessarily wrong. I just think it's a little bit unexciting.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. But it is definitely a departure in a positive light, in that these are young players who have proven to be value adds at super clubs. Like, that, it's pretty rare that United acquire players like that.
Yeah, and also reasonable fees. Like, I think that's also a big difference. I think if you're paying in this fee range for established top club players, the worst thing that's going to happen is they're not quite at the level. If you keep them on reasonable wages, you're probably able to move them on. De Ligt is on quite high wages at Bayern. Rumors are he's going to take a small salary cut to join United, that being because he wants more playing time. He probably also, I would imagine, doesn't mind the idea of playing under Ten Hag again. So I think you're A, exposing yourself to very little risk on these moves, and B, continuing some of the aspects of moves in the last two summers that I did like, such as Højlund, Onana, Mount, and then in the summer before, Lisandro Martinez.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, hopefully to put a neat bow on this, these are good moves, but they don't fundamentally change who United are next season in any phase.
Ruud van Nistelrooy and René Hake.
Ruud.
Well, now I want to redo the intro, but I feel like this podcast, as long as we United have this kind of like slightly Dutch skewed affiliation, we could do like a section that's just like Case pronounces Dutch names correctly.
I don't know that it would add value for a lot of people though, because it's difficult to, like, some of these are difficult sounds. Like Ruud, people can do. Like, I'm not gonna. You can make that sound.
Yeah.
But, like, I don't think you can reasonably expect everybody to be able to say, like, the G's. And, like, the G's are really the thing that, like, I can't. And some of the diphthongs are a bit difficult.
All right. Well, Ruud van Nistelrooy, formerly manager of PSV, also formerly legendary striker of Manchester United, has joined Ten Hag's coaching staff. René Hake, manager of Go Ahead Eagles as recently as this past season, has also joined United's coaching staff. Sam Hudson asks, how does the style of play the two incoming coaches differ from ETH? Do you expect alterations to the style of play with them incoming and perhaps some departures? And OC asks, how big of an impact would the additions of RVN and Hake to the backroom staff be? Case, I'm going to let you take this one. I think you are probably uniquely positioned to answer this.
Yeah, so I don't know exactly what role the two of them are joining in, but I'll just tell you a little bit about how each of them did in their roles in the Netherlands and what I think the shortcomings were. I'll start with Van Nistelrooy. So obviously he took over PSV after Roger Schmidt. Roger Schmidt, I think, was viewed by those in Eindhoven in charge of PSV as having been a sort of a departure from the DNA of the club in certain ways. He was German, not Dutch. Most managers of top Dutch sides are Dutch. He didn't have a history with the club, not in the way that Van Nistelrooy did at the very least. And the team, he was definitely a technocrat in that he was very interested in pressing schema, out of possession approaches, and that was sort of his thing. Van Nistelrooy comes in. He inherits a side that is very talented. This is his PSV team were one of the most talented sides, probably. I don't want to in the 21st century of Dutch football. And I'll pull up the squad list just so you can hear a few of these names and appreciate exactly how much quality this was relative to the league at the time. The players who played the most minutes in this team. I'll start from the top. Xavi Simons, who obviously has been a huge transfer target for a lot of major sides. Joey Veerman, who plays for the Dutch national team, has been very poor at this European Championship, but is broadly considered one of the best players in Dutch football. Ibrahim Sangare, who has sort of been an analytics darling for a long time, one of the most dominant defensive midfielders in Dutch football. Luke de Jong, who is one of historically one of the most prolific strikers in the history of Dutch football, Jerry Branthwaite, who you might recognize that name because he's linked to United right now. He was one of the two center backs who consistently started for that team. Cody Gakpo. Gakpo actually, he only played the first half of the season because obviously he moved to Liverpool. But in that first half of the season, he was absolutely supernova. In about 1,000 minutes, he had 7 non-penalty goals and 12 assists. Was just completely on fire. And then the rest of the squad was filled out with players with big league experience. For example, Patrick Van Aanholt, who you'll recognize from his Premier League days, Anwar El Ghazi, Philip Max, who had played at a pretty high level in the Bundesliga, and now Noni Madueke, actually, was also a squad player for that team. Obviously, some of these guys aren't standout players at, you know, a big five level in these top leagues, but I trust that you're going to have to trust me that these players are overwhelmingly standouts within Dutch football. And once you appreciate that, this PSV team was a pretty big letdown. Yeah, so once you understand how much talent was in this team, you can start to begin to understand that this side was actually a pretty big letdown. Yeah, so PSV finished second in the league that season, but they only scored 75 points. They conceded like 30% more goals than Feyenoord did, and that Feyenoord had the best defense in the league. They actually scored more goals than Feyenoord, but it wasn't really a close run-in. The league was wrapped up more than a month before the end of the season, I think. Or not more than a month, but close to a month before the end of the season. And the general output of the team, given the talent, they were less than the sum of their parts. It was really a poor defensive side. In attacking phases, they were super effective, but I wouldn't say it was down to, you know, coached attacking patterns, really coherent build-up patterns. It's pretty easy to move the ball from one end of the pitch to the other in Dutch football. So they didn't have trouble building up from the back or with high pressure. And as a result, they were able to score a ton in transition and be impressive in that way. But on balance, given the amount of talent that was in that team, I would say it was a pretty big underperformance. And I think ultimately, that's why you see Van Nistelrooy's dismissal. This team underperformed the quality, I think, drastically. I think you can say pretty safely, drastically. And it only becomes more damning when you see how well Peter Bos's side did the ensuing season. PSV were the best team in Dutch football. They didn't lose until after the winter break. They basically dog-walked the league with arguably an inferior squad to that which Van Nistelrooy had the prior season. And there were clear tactical upgrades that Bos was able to institute. All of which is to say, I've seen people suggest that maybe this is setting up for Van Nistelrooy to ultimately secede. Ten Hag, I would be very against that. I don't think there's good evidence to support that he's ready for that at this point in his career. That said, I have no problem with him working with the strikers. I'm sure he has a lot of experiential knowledge to share with the forwards. But if it were me, because I am a Man United fan, I'm not excited about the prospect of him working in terms of like the tactics and the overall game plan that this side uses to approach matches. That said, moving on to Hake. Hake's go-ahead Eagles sides have been very impressive, in particular going forward, with players who I don't think you would expect to contribute to really effective attacking sides. Go-ahead Eagles, I think last season, were the 5th or 6th highest scoring team in the Eredivisie. That's a big achievement for a team that has recently been relegated. This was a pretty effective transition team. They were able to build out of the back and get moving with the ball, even against, get moving with the ball. Transition quickly, move from their own third to the opposition third at speed, create chances that way. Even against some of the bigger sides in the league who actually do have relatively coherent out-of-possession approaches. So with that in mind, I'm a lot more excited about the Hake move than I am about the Van Nistelrooy move, because I do think he's going to have some tactical insights to offer. But that's not to say that RVN can't contribute. So that's sort of where I would leave it. Ultimately, in the scheme of things, how much do I think these moves matter? Not that much, which is not to say that they don't do important work. I just don't think they're going to fundamentally alter the way this team approaches matches. I don't think you're going to see a drastic tactical shift on their behalf. I guess that's where I'd leave it. Do you have anything else?
Yeah, I mean, it'll be kind of hard to know whether, if there are changes that they're coming from this, but I think the insight you provided is really valuable and also leads well into a question we had from Scott McKenzie, who asked, now that ETH has been extended rather than a new deal, so for context, for those who don't know, but I'm sure most of you know by now, United have exercised a one-year option on Ten Hag's contract, which means it now expires at the end of the 2025-2026 season instead of the 2024-2025 season. That comes after announcing that he would stay, and typically managers don't tend to stay on one-year contracts in big postings like this, so they've gone with the option of extending him to 2 years as opposed to writing up an entirely new contract. He maintains things like the veto on transfers, which has been talked about a lot. Going back to the question, Scott McKenzie asks, now that he's been extended, do you think this means he is in for this year and we will be basically running back last year's strategy with a full reset coming next summer? Player signings seem to fit this theory as well. So essentially this comes from ideas that, I think there's kind of two separate ideas here coming from Scott, and Scott, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong after listening to this, but I think it makes for interesting discussion anyways. The first being, do we think Ten Hag is going to change last season's strategy a lot, especially given it seemed very different to the season before? And B, do you think the club is using perhaps the stability of Ten Hag having already been around and them not thinking the perfect manager to join the team is available in order to build this side with more consistency and then ultimately replace Ten Hag with a revamped squad in a few years? And then a third discussion I'm going to add is this idea that player signings seem to fit this this vision that Ten Hag or a new manager might be looking to build towards, which is something that I've seen a lot in social media circles, and I think both has some truths and mistruths to it. So let's start with the first one there, which was, do you think United are going to run something very similar to last season? Do you think Ten Hag is going to completely change it up? Kind of a fool's errand trying to predict this, but I think probably makes for interesting discussion.
This is difficult to say. I have heard some chatter that the sort of tweaks we saw at the end of the season were down to pressure from people within the footballing infrastructure pushing for United to adopt more of a mid-block approach as opposed to the high-press, low-line approach that they've been employing throughout the season. And that is sort of a shift that happened towards the end of the season. And that would make me think that maybe you see that shift continue into next year. But I think that's... neither is a good outcome. Because I think the ceiling for just employing a mid-block indefinitely with a more passive press is quite low. And I also think the floor for the approach that we were using all season is as low as we've seen, right? I think there's a legitimate chance if you approach the games the same way you did all of last year that you finish in the bottom half this season. And I don't say that to be hyperbolic. Like, if you just look at the expected goal numbers, they corroborate that. And as much as expected goal numbers don't tell the whole story, ultimately, over a large sample, teams' results are defined by their expected goals. You can say, like, oh, the XG doesn't tell the story of a single match, but over 70 matches, it's pretty rare that you see a major deviation from them. So if you were to play the same way you did last year, next year, catastrophe awaits. That said, I don't expect us to finish in the bottom half, which makes me think that there will be changes made. I don't know how to give a good answer to this question, but I would say I expect major changes. I don't necessarily expect those major changes to result in super fluid, beautiful football. I think I more expect them to be maybe pragmatic.
I'll start by saying that I think the idea of switching to a mid-block or becoming more compact was a good suggestion for United, given the context of an approach that was clearly designed for the season, failing for the season. In that United were tumbling down the table, needed to save face, and therefore that mid-block sort of approach was a good way to consolidate the floor of the side again. That being said, I don't think it's something I want to see in the long term. So while I think it worked for that small stretch of games, I think that relatively conservative approach compared to what top teams do. When I say conservative, I mean in the press as opposed to defensive. I think that relatively conservative approach leaves United short of the best teams in the league in the long run. And I think a relatively likely outcome is that Ten Hag persists with that approach because it delivered better results. And United are fine next season, and then people mark being fine as good progress when the team was awful last season, and therefore think, okay, we're back on track now, when I don't really think that's the case. I think on track is when you're showing tactical signs of being an elite side as opposed to consistently improving results. Where I think that might deliver a higher floor of results, I think it would limit the ceiling of the team. But then I obviously also don't want to see the high press, low block thing, because that was futile. And so it leaves me in a weird position where I hope that United are going to run a more progressive, different approach to what we saw at any point last season. I do think one adjustment from the mid block that I liked was it felt like United were playing out of the back a little bit more in those last few games. That's one thing I would like to see. Felt like Onana was going short into midfield a little bit. Felt like the center backs were more involved. I think that does. I don't like that Ten Hag's tactics change so much based on which players are available, but I definitely do think that owes a lot to Lisandro Martinez being fit. And I don't actually disagree with the assertion that it would be really hard to play out of the back with a center back duo of Evans and Varane in the same way that it was really hard to do the season before with De Gea. And so, yeah, I think the job of the board here, and I think we're seeing this from what Ratcliffe is doing as well, if you're keeping Ten Hag, is to build a squad that essentially gives him no excuses for not playing an idealistic style of play, even if the results aren't that good. Results being score lines, not results of implementing the tactics. And then if he still cannot implement it, then the approach is to replace him with someone who can implement that at a high level. And so I guess my answer is I hope he does not continue the approach from last season. I think there are aspects of all the different approaches we've seen in his time at United that are good and modern and ideas that could win United games. I don't think we've seen the full package. I'm at this point extremely doubtful that we will see the full package, which is why we didn't want him to continue in the first place. But I think United need to build a squad now that puts it beyond any reasonable doubt that that this is or is not a problem for everyone to see. We kind of talked about this at one point when we were talking about the structure of the club and how, you know, you look at you I think you likened it to modular programming, where you said, you know, If you modularize everything that United do, you can then isolate and work on different parts of it. And right now, I think there's a lot of confusion resulting from the fact that there are problems everywhere. And I think if you reduce a lot of the problems occurring in other areas, you can isolate Ten Hag as a very clear variable. And I still think, I don't think that protects him from the misgivings of last season, but I think now there will be no protection if United recruit a squad that can consistently play over a 60-game season that we, beyond any reasonable doubt, believe a good manager could get consistent results from across a 60-game season, regardless of who's fit. And if Ten Hag is still performing badly, then replace him next summer with a new coach, or in December or whenever, with a new coach who can deliver that. So that's kind of a long-winded answer that's not necessarily particularly clear, but I hope that gives some insight into how I see this.
No, I think that makes sense. Yeah, it'll be really interesting. I have no idea how we're going to come out of the gates playing next year, like in terms of the approach.
It could be incredibly interesting. It could also be incredibly interesting until game week 3 and then horrible for a long time.
And in fact, yeah, that's kind of what I expect to happen. But I think at the very beginning, it will be interesting because I don't know what it's going to be.
Keen eyes on preseason once these international tournaments are over, actually. I haven't tuned into preseason for a couple of years. I think this will be one year where I actually do tune into preseason, both given the relative relaxation of my personal life in this particular time period, as well as actually having a lot of questions that I want to see answered.
Yeah, I don't know. I watched basically all of preseason last year, and we did not play the way we played in preseason the rest of the year. So I'm not sure it really gives them much insight. Yeah, but anyway, shall we move on? I think we've answered this question.
All right, a couple quick things before we wrap up this episode. Firstly, Dan Ashworth and Christopher Vivell united with some new appointments to their front office. Dan Ashworth has joined as technical director. Christopher Vivell is joining in a global recruitment role. Dan Ashworth obviously has history at Brighton and Newcastle. This has been the highest profile director of football or technical director transfer in the history of the sport, I think. Like, this has been going on for months now. Ashworth is a big name. United have probably paid a lot of money to get him out of Newcastle. Christopher Vivell, his history is at RB Leipzig, as well as Hoffenheim, and then more recently, technical director of Chelsea for a couple months early in Todd Boehly's time at the club, which isn't necessarily a great omen for him, but he was highly regarded at Leipzig. I think rumor had it, I'm not sure if this is true, so asterisk on this, not to spread misinformation, but I think he was someone who was recommended by Ralf Rangnick as a potential front office executive for United when Rangnick was interim manager becoming consultant before that route was abandoned. So yeah, more high profile names joining United staff. We said we wouldn't really comment on the specifics of these names. I think I have no interest in being part of the brand of Twitter that, you know, has working opinions about the sporting directors of every team in the Premier League. I think there's some very good signs about all of these figures who are coming in. I don't think there's conclusive evidence that they were the key cog in the machine at any of the clubs that any of them worked at. And I think that's the thing that we are hopefully going to find out soon.
Yeah, I think you put that basically perfectly. These people are associated with success. And when you bring in a bunch of different people who are associated with success in different contexts, I really like the sound of that. That makes sense to me. But I don't know if it'll work because they, like you said, they might not be the key cogs. So that's sort of where I would leave it. But it's definitely, it's better than the alternative. I'll say that much.
Great. A little bit of Q&A. Kevin Wu asks, what do you think of the chances of Mason Mount and Amad Diallo being regular starters in the first 11 for the coming season? And Jack asks, should Cobby's minutes be limited in the coming season? I keep thinking about other young players whose potential were never fully realized because of overuse too early. Is Mount a possible option to split his minutes? I thought this was an interesting one because I do think Mount is going to play a big role this season if he can stay fit. I do think Amad Diallo is going to play a reasonable role this season if he can stay fit. And I do think Mainoo is going to play too many minutes based on, especially if someone like Ugarte comes in, as we were talking about a little bit earlier in the episode. Case, what do you think about these three players within the context that Kevin and Jack have asked about?
Yeah, so I agree with what you said. I think main news minutes need to be managed, something we've spoken about on this podcast. I think Mount, if he's fit, both has the quality and the squad fit to play major minutes. As for Ahmad, I don't know. I don't think Ahmad will start for this team. I'd be surprised. But I do think he's capable of being a squad player based on what we've seen and the other options we have at right wing right now. So, yeah, I think that's basically my answer. I think you can't have Maynou play 50-90s next year. You know, he cannot be... Yeah, you can't have this kid play more than 4,000 minutes. I think that would be really dangerous and unwise, exactly for the reasons that were implied by the question. We've seen a lot of young players really burn out as a consequence of this. He's at the Euro right now, playing minutes at the Euro. Yeah, it's definitely something to keep in mind. If Mount is fit, I think Mount is one of the better players in this team. I maintain that. So I definitely think you want him to be on the pitch.
Yeah, pretty much. I think with Ahmad, here's what you don't have, I don't think. I don't think you have elite physicality at this level, neither speed nor size. I don't think you have clear evidence of goal output. I think there's some nice off-ball movement. I think there's some nice work with the ball. I don't think we have evidence in either his time in the championship or his time at United to date that the goals and assists that he was showing in his cameos towards the end of last season are not going to dry up a little bit. Here's what you do have. You have a left-footed right winger who can keep the ball and make good decisions in attacking areas. United do not currently have any of those things otherwise, especially if Jadon Sancho is leaving. Yeah, I think there's a good chance he can play reasonable minutes next season in one of a few different positions, and I hope that he does, because I think there's a chance, especially if you don't sign another winger, that you can be a little bit one-dimensional with Rashford and Garnacho starting every single match out wide. As for... we're talking about Maynou and Mount. Mount, I've maintained for a long time. I think he's very good. I think he should play a lot of minutes for United if fit. I think he's basically a nailed on starter whenever fit, but I don't necessarily think he works easily in a midfield three with Bruno as pertains to the other options that are available to fill the third spot in United squad. I think you basically need a pretty idealistic player. We've talked about this before with Bruno. You need a pretty idealistic player to be the third in that midfield slot, but I think
can you elaborate on what idealistic means in that context?
You need someone who's tall, athletic, press resistant, and progressive on the ball, which is basically Rodri, end of list.
Yeah.
You need Rodri. So I don't particularly see it. You could run Maynou, Mount, Bruno. I actually think based on the current squad, that's your best midfield. I don't think that is a good midfield to run at Premier League level consistently.
Yeah, I think that would get brutalized.
It'll get run over, and everyone will be very upset with all three players.
Yeah.
Long story short, I think that leaves Mount in a weird spot, but I do think he can also play on the left, on the right, either slot behind the striker with slightly different dynamics to that. If Bruno's out or if you play one of them out wide, I think it could work. So yeah, I'd like to see Mount play. As for Maynou, here's what United need to do. They need to recruit a squad of, I think right now, we've done the count before, right? There's like, somewhere 9 to 12 players that we think can play a decently sized role in this squad next season. If they go and add three more, let's say, I think, I'm optimistic they'll add four based on the activity we're seeing. Let's throw some names. Xerxes,
Ugarte,
yeah. De Ligt. What they need to then do is go, which positions do we not have two options that we can rely on? And those players, those ones, should just never play in the Europa League. I don't want to see, if Maynou is your only deep midfielder, I don't want to see Maynou running out against Lask and, you know, Maynou making trips to East Europe on a Thursday and then playing Premier League against West Ham on a Sunday. Like, there's no need. You can beat those teams without him. If you can't beat those teams without him, there's a problem. When you only have one option for a position, the best way to get through a season is to protect those options. Every time people go, you have to play your best 11, and then by March, United are limping towards the end of the season. We've seen this when Solskjaer's United had good league performances. We've seen this when Ten Hag's United had a good league performance. Just save your one-off players because they are important. The same right now, the same goes for Dalot. Same goes for Luke Shaw. Same goes for Hoyland. Just don't play those guys when you're playing vastly inferior sides. Just don't let them see more than 20 minutes of pitch time. And their minutes will manage themselves naturally because United aren't playing in the Champions League. Anything else on that?
No, I think that covers it. I agree.
Great. I don't even, like, it's the Europa League group stages. I don't even mind if you're seeing McTominay. Bring in someone from the youth sides.
I agree.
Play someone from the youth sides with McTominay in central midfield. Works for me. And then play Mount at number 10 and rotate Bruno. But that one won't happen. But, you know, we can dream. No Devils. This is a segment where we allow you to ask anything about football, but the questions cannot be about United. And I love this one from James Rolanti, who asked, what are your favorite memories that you guys have of rooting for your national teams? Case, the Netherlands are doing quite well at Euro 2024. I think they're quite well poised for a semifinal run at this point, which might be funny on Monday, but for your sake, I hope it's not funny on Monday. Canada are in the quarterfinals of the Copa America tomorrow. I don't know if they're the favorite to win that quarterfinal, but hey, they're not playing a team that I would count them out entirely against. So, two teams that are doing quite well in international competition. Case, what are your favorite moments following the Netherlands?
2010 quarterfinal against Brazil. Schneider scored a header. I think he scored two headers, actually, in that match. We beat them 2-1. Very fun. I was with my dad that day.
And then he was linked to United that night.
He was linked to United the rest of his career after that. And then, I mean, the semifinal against Uruguay that same year. Schneider's goal against Mexico 4 years later. Probably the best one, though, is the 5-1 against Spain that same year. My dad actually... when we scored the equalizer just before halftime, threw his hands into the ceiling fan of the room we were in, cut his hand wide open, but refused to go to the hospital until after the game because he didn't want to miss anything. So that's a core memory. And then obviously the rest of the game was fantastic. I've got a lot of great ones. I've been very lucky in that way. We haven't won anything, but not while I've been alive, but I've got some great memories. It obviously went sour at the end, but even the quarterfinal against Argentina last year, not a lot of people get moments like that in their sports watching lives coming back late like that. So, yeah, I've got a lot of fun memories. What about you?
I mean, I'm tempted to pick the Van Persie flying header myself. I remember watching that game in school. Like, I was literally, it was the end of the school day. My friends were making fun of Van Persie, and he was my favorite player at the time. And he goes and scores this header, and we yell so loud that we didn't hear that the bell rang and school ended. Like, we just erupted. It was crazy. As for Canada, I'll pick three moments. Number one is actually, I'll go in ascending order, I guess, actually. So number three is our current Copa America run. I was really impressed against Argentina. If you didn't catch the first half of that game, I think it's probably the best half of Canada soccer ever in terms of the tactical sophistication. Marsh is the highest profile figure to ever probably work in Canadian coaching. Like, I might be overstepping with that, but he's coached in the Premier League. Bob Bradley obviously coached Toronto FC, but it's not at the same level. And Bradley's time at Toronto FC was largely unsuccessful. So, yeah, I would say Marsh has brought a level of tactical sophistication that you don't see in most European leagues, let alone in Canada. So it's made it. And I also think his style is really well suited to the squad that Canada have right now. Marsh teams famously very narrow and look to primarily beat teams by putting pressure on the opposition to create chances. I think that works well for a Canadian team that's still developing from a technical standpoint, but also has really tall, fast defenders, really strong wingbacks who can dribble at teams. It covers for a lot of the weaknesses in, I think, Marsh's approach. So yeah, I think what Canada is doing right now, I'm really happy with, regardless of the outcome of this Copa America. As long as they don't get like two red cards and play awfully and get eliminated by Venezuela in like embarrassing fashion, I will maintain that. Number two, I was actually in the stadium when Canada qualified for the last World Cup. The first World Cup Canada played in my lifetime. Won the game 4-0. I saw Buchanan, Tejon Buchanan, about 5 feet away from me. He's pretty incredible. Like, I don't know if he has the all-round game to knit it together at the highest level of European football, but he's now at Inter, and he's an exciting player to watch. I think the potential in terms of what he can do is really high. And he's probably one of the most electric players in the team. Like, he can probably chat to Davies in that particular sense. So that was an amazing day, and there were celebrations for like an hour after the match. And it was also freezing cold, and so my feet were extremely cold, but I didn't care. Number one has to be the women's team winning Olympic gold at the last Olympics. Canada's women's team, I don't know how many listeners know the lore, but they've been dangerously close to Olympic gold multiple times and fallen just short, often in dramatic fashion. Over the last couple years, when they actually won the gold, they probably weren't even half the quality of team that won bronze twice, I believe. Like, they really had to grind out a lot of results and rely on defensive stability and then a penalty shootout at the end. But, like, from a country like this, I think seeing actual winning at the sport at that kind of stage is something that I never would have even imagined. And so they deserve immense amounts of credit for being competitive for this long at the highest level in women's soccer, and then B, when they finally got that reward, it felt like it was 10 years coming. So it was really fun to see that come to life. I think that's good for Canada. All right. I think with that, we can look to wrap up this episode. Hopefully we'll have some news for you by next week. I think now we're finally seeing quite a bit of progress. It'll be good to see who ends up joining United, and I'm guessing a couple more targets will emerge. At this time last week, I was quite convinced Branthwaite would be joining, and it seems like United and Everton reached an impasse on the fee, like I said before, and that has led to new targets. So I'm sure that this week, particularly if one of De Ligt or Ugarte doesn't end up arriving in an agreement, we will probably hear more news about new targets and their potential to change United and send us to the videotapes. And then we'll be back to report it all to you. So thanks for listening, everyone. And we'll see you next week. Hope you enjoyed this week's Devils in the Details. You can follow us at DevilsITDPod on Twitter or on a variety of streaming platforms. Our awesome theme music was made by Jacob Connor. You can find at Jacob J. Connor on Twitter. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.